I'm speaking this morning on Bible translations. This is more of an informative type of lesson that I suppose can be practical. There are a lot of Bible translations on the market today, and it's one of the best-selling items in any religious bookstore, even in secular bookstores. The Bible is the best seller and has been every year for over several hundred years. Anybody that writes a book, if you can get your sales into the hundred thousands, you're definitely making money. You're a big seller. You may even get into the top 10. And if you write a book and it sells a million copies, you will probably become famous, and you will probably make number one for some amount of time, maybe several months. It's interesting that the Bible has sold annually over 100 million copies for, you know, the last 15, 20 years, and it's always on the increase. It's always increasing, never decreasing every year. Now, I'm talking about worldwide in all languages. In English, the Bible is the bestseller. There's absolutely no competition. In fact, the only competition for the Bible itself are the various translations that are all competing with one another. And so the bestsellers are always English translations, either vying with the King James or with one another for today's sales market. We find there's money to be made in Bible translating. I'm not saying that's the main motive for the various translations. It's something that is considered, though. There are various types of translations. There are a number on the market today, and people are asking the question, which one is the best, and which one is the best for me? Let me talk about types of translations. English translations now. In English, there are more translations in English than any other language. There's committee translations, or translations done by just one person. And a committee translation is usually a translation that's done by a group of men, and we define committee by meaning a group of people that have more or less an equal voice in what the translation is going to become, not just a group of men working under one man. Of course, if they're working under one man, then we'd say it's done by one man, because that one man makes the decision as to what the translation is going to say in any place. Committee translations have the advantage of checks and balances and a group of people contributing, not just the mind of one man doing this translation. They also have the disadvantage of usually turning out to be somewhat of a compromise. They lack the real guts to put down oftentimes what it really says, or a more literal rendering. Because of the committee usually is spanning several denominations and spanning different doctrinal points of view. And so oftentimes, verses that are particularly doctrinal in nature, they will leave somewhat ambiguous so that both sides can read the passage and come to their point of view doctrinally. But a committee translation will never have any blatant errors in it. Because, of course, the committee would never agree to that type of a thing. It'll never be a sectarian, or it'll never be, they'll never agree that one, in one doctrinal stand on a particular passage. We talk about translations. We're talking about translating the Bible from the original languages, Greek and Hebrew, into English. And this is somewhat of a formidable task. Greek language and the Hebrew language are different than English. They're more Eastern languages, they're different, present some formidable task in translation. Individual translations lack anybody else influencing you what to say. If you're a good scholar, and if you're fairly doctrinal and orthodox in your doctrine, and you are conservative, and you are reverent in your attitude towards the Bible, you can come up with a real excellent translation, depending on your scholarship and your viewpoint and your purpose and so forth. And if a scholar is not believing in the Word of God being inspired, and if he's not that good of a scholar, and if he is somewhat careless in his approach and doesn't really care how the Bible comes out. Of course, he lacks anybody else to tell him their points of view, and he can come out with a pretty miserable translation. There are a number of translations on the market today done by just one man that are fairly poor, and if it had been a committee translation, it'd be decidedly better. There are some very excellent translations on the market today done by just one man, and if it was a committee effort, it would be quite a bit worse than it is. His excellence would have been mellowed out by all the other voices, and that's pretty much the way it would be. Committee translations, then, are usually middle of the road, neutral translations. Individual translations are both the best and the worst because they've lacked the checks and balances of others. The King James is a committee translation, and of course it's our most popular translation. Then there are different types of translations out of committee or individual. There are literal translations. Literal translations are an effort to precisely translate word for word from one language into another. Now, this isn't always easy to do, and there's really only one translation that I know of that has tried to be completely literal in everything they've done. There are a number of passages that really can't be translated literally without losing the idea behind it. We have a lot of expressions in English that if you were to translate into another language, unless they had that particular expression, you'd lose the meaning. We talk about catching the bus. That could definitely have a different meaning in another language. Of course, to us, it means to get on the bus and ride the bus. And it's just an expression. We have lots of expressions like that that are used daily that mean something a little bit different than the literal idea. It's the same in any language. Every language has its expressions that you cannot really translate literally without getting a different meaning across in another language. Some literal translations, of course, Concordant Literal Translation, Rotherham, are probably the best known around here. Concordant Literal Translation is just like its name, concordant. It's the one that has tried to translate exactly word for word. And whether a person agrees with that approach or not is really beside the point. The translation does have a value. If a person has no understanding at all of Greek or the original languages, at least he can take out this concordant translation, which is in English, and he can read that and he can get a reflection or an idea as to what the Greek really did say. Of course, he'll have to decide himself, you know, what it's going to mean and how to apply it. But at least it gives you the advantage of being able to check that or to compare the King James with the concordant, you see. As far as reading the concordant in your daily Bible study or for devotional purposes, it would be really difficult to use. You would constantly be having to explain what he meant when you read it, and so that's probably not the type of translation that is of value there. But it's good for comparison. It's good to check the daily devotional translation, such as the King James that everyone reads or another that's read as your daily Bible. It's good to check it with concordant to see what concordant says. A second type of translation is an idiomatic translation. The word idiom, or just it's speaking of a modern speech translation, a translation in our common everyday speech, using the expressions we use in everyday speech and bring it down to that which is very understandable. This is very difficult because the English language does change, and there's a difference between English in England or the British Islands and English in America. And there's a difference between English in New York, not just in the pronunciation either, and English in California. There are different expressions, and it can go from different areas. And so a real, true idiomatic translation has some difficulties in it. Usually they're either American or British. That's one thing. It's based on the translator's preference and what he is. And sometimes it can even be more southern or more northern. And so this is difficult also. Idiomatic translations have a real value. Their value is to make the Bible readable, understandable to the average person. He picks up the Bible and he reads it just like he would read his daily newspaper. Hopefully it doesn't have the big words in it. It's readable, understandable. This has been the intent of the translator. Idiomatic translations have a value then in being understood. They have a disadvantage in that they're not always precise or accurate. You have to sacrifice a little accuracy, see, a little about what was really said, to make it understood. The difference between what was said and what is easily to be understood. And this sacrifice can be done without any real harm, or it can be done with considerable harm. In some passages, it can have a tremendous difference in the real meaning of the text, and of course, it all comes back to the author as to what he thought was being said in that passage. If he thinks this thing is being said, then he says it that way. If he thinks the opposite is being said, he says it the other way. There are passages that are difficult to be understood, and of course, a modern speech translation is trying to make them undifficult, and by doing that, they usually add an interpretation along with it. So it can be sometimes an interpretation. Now, the more blatant idiomatic translations are called paraphrases. A paraphrase is just restating what was said in your own words. It's a complete restatement. It's not even exactly a translation. Usually you're translating from one language into another. A paraphrase is just a complete restatement. Some paraphrases don't even need the original languages. You can take the King James and paraphrase it. And I think the most popular paraphrase is probably a paraphrase from the King James as much as anything. It's taking the English in the King James and just rewording it into what he thought was said in a much more careless paraphrase viewpoint. Actually, paraphrases have more negative points to them than positive points. The negative points are fairly obvious. It's almost always in the word of the translator. And a lot of theology, a lot of ideas are added. You don't know if you can trust it as well. Is it really what was said, or is it just something added? The most popular paraphrase today is Living Bible, which almost everyone is familiar with. Many people are reading it. Phillips is also a paraphrase, popular maybe a decade ago. There are some positive points to a paraphrase, which many may not be realizing. A paraphrase is useful when you're trying to explain a passage after you already know what it means yourself. Now, I wouldn't go to a paraphrase if I didn't know what a passage meant and I wanted to find out what it meant. That's not where I'd go. What I would do is I would compare a literal translation and an idiomatic translation and probably check into a commentator and do some research on the thing to find out what it meant. But after I found out what it meant and I was getting up and I was going to preach on it or expound on it or explain it, a paraphrase might do a good job of that. A paraphrase is really, could be stated, a paraphrase is just a commentary on it. It's restating it in easier to understand in different language. Paraphrases really do have a purpose, although it's hardly ever used this way. But their purpose is to say it in a different way and give you a different way. Not to find out what it means. You probably will find out something different than what it means. If you read the paraphrase, you'll find out what the author thinks it means. But it can help you to explain it to others. It can help you in preaching. It can help you in breaking it down. Paraphrases have a purpose, although they're seldom used by anybody that's teaching. They have so many other aids and Bible study aids that it's probably the last thing you'd use. Another type of translation is an expanded translation. An expanded translation is one that seeks to amplify or to add all the necessary words that the author thinks is required to bring out the full meaning of what was said. And so he's not just making it word for word. He may take 5 words to explain 1 word. And he may take 2 words to explain the next word and 10 words to explain the next word. And then he may have a few words, synonyms, and then he may add a big long explanation. Amplified translations are, again, often commentators. They're commenting on the passage. They're amplifying it. Of course, an amplified translation could come right from the King James. But those that are amplified, that are popular today, do come from the original languages. Amplified is probably the most popular expanded translation. Its name, Amplified, it amplifies or adds all the necessary words to explain what they feel is being said. Oftentimes, they add 60%. You know, if you were to add up the number of words in the original, maybe add up the number of words in the King James in a particular passage or verse, and you find there are even more in the King James. It does take usually more words in English to explain it or to translate it than less. And that's because we don't always have a corresponding word. But Amplified adds maybe 60%, maybe 100%. I mean, it's quite lengthy oftentimes, real wordy. As far as using an expanded translation, many people use an expanded translation in their devotional reading. Or they use it, you read all these testimonials, now I understand it. Makes it so much easier to understand. Well, that's true, but oftentimes the understanding you're getting is the author's point of view. His commentary, his understanding. He's expanded it in this vein. He thinks it means this, he's expanded it that way. Expanded translations are dangerous, really, unless you know what you're doing or you know what it really says. I think expanded translations do have a use, and the use is to expand the translation once you understand what it means. But you have to understand what it means first before you can safely use an amplified or expanded translation. Because otherwise, your mind is colored as to what it means, and you can't be sure. You find out what it means first, and then check the amplified translation, and allow them to amplify it. But don't let them interpret it for you, or give you the meaning. Oftentimes, the meaning they give will be incorrect. Because it's based on the theological and viewpoint of what the author thinks is being said, he amplifies it in that vein. It's impossible to translate an amplified translation without interjecting your theology, see. It's impossible. You've got to interject your theology to amplify it. That's the only way it can be done. Literal translations maybe contain the least theological bias. Because if you're being literal truly, it's hard to get a word in edgewise. I mean, you're just corresponding the words all the way down the line. Now, there will be some time when you may have to deviate a little bit and make it accurate rather than just literal. And, of course, that will be the time when you may interject something on your own. Of course, paraphrases contain the most liberty for a translator to interject his own thoughts and his own theology because he's rephrasing it every time. And so he's rephrasing it from his own viewpoint. Expanded translations do give a translator a lot of liberty in adding whatever he feels is necessary to amplify it. If he feels that verse is teaching a certain doctrine, he'll amplify it in that vein. Another type of translation, all of these types have a valid purpose. Now, the valid purpose isn't always the translation you want to read for Bible study or for daily reading. Usually for daily reading, you read the King James or a modern speech translation. These others are just tools in your aid to understand or to amplify or expand or paraphrase the text or get a wider viewpoint of it. Another type of translation is a simplified translation. This is often a translation that uses a very limited vocabulary. And usually the purpose of the simplified translation is to reach a particular audience. It may be to reach children. It may be to reach people that can't read very well. It may be to reach people with a low IQ. All of these may necessitate a simplified translation. There are a handful of simplified translations on the market today. Some of them are based on a study that was done on the English language. They did a study on the English language and determined that almost anything can be said in a vocabulary of 850 words. And this basic 850-word vocabulary, they say you can communicate just about anything because you can always break down complex words into simpler words. And given this 850-word vocabulary, you can communicate just about anything. Well, a Bible translator picked up on that study of the English language, and he decided, I'm going to take the Bible and put it into this 850-word vocabulary. So he did. And, of course, there are certain Bible words, like Pharisee, and maybe sin, and hell, and angel, and there are some words that You may have to add those type of words, religious words, to that vocabulary. There is one simplified translation that broke all of those words down too, and of course, sometimes it's difficult to break down an angel as to what exactly it is. But it was done, and whether it is accurate or not is another idea. But anyway, the simplified translation, I should say, is for the simple, not for the average person. It's for a person with a deficiency, a person with a need. There are many that have come into on the mission field, for example. The people speak a sketchy English. They may not have a translation in their language, or if they do, it may be easier to use this one. And so, with a very limited English, and it might be easier to read this than to teach them English, instead you teach them this, and it has a use. You're able to convey the gospel message to them and have them understand it. And they can have a Bible they can read. It's simple. It's understandable. It's run, Dick, run. See John and Jesus. I mean, that type of a thing. I think it has a purpose, a validity. It's not the translation that I would prefer to read, but, and I doubt if, and I wouldn't recommend it to others. But for children, maybe yes, if the parents preview it and they don't have any objections. Of course, a simplified translation does have a strong viewpoint of the author within it, because he has chosen the simplification and what should be said and how to break it down. And so there may be some objections to them. And there's a question as to whether a child can read an idiomatic translation just as well as a simplified one, and there's a valid argument there. What's the child gets into the second and third and fourth and fifth, and once they're starting to read, they can almost read some of these idiomatic translations just as easy as a simplified one. The simplified one would fit the child that's just learning to read and doesn't quite. It's just in the primer, you see. But once, and they get beyond that in just a year or two. So it might have a use for just a year or two, or for those just barely beginning. There is an argument today against the King James Bible, and that is, we need a Bible we can understand. We can't understand the King James. It has all the saith in it, and thee, and all that type of thing. And it is true it does have those things in it. It also has many obscure words that were maybe understandable in the 1700s and 1800s, but today aren't really that much in use. And so people often have to look them up in the dictionary. And also the meanings of words has changed also, and so you might get a completely different idea from a word that you know, yet it might have changed its meaning considerably for today. And you might not even look it up in the dictionary because you know what it means, but yet it doesn't really mean what you think it means, at least not as it was used there. Anyway, out of the other side of the mouth, of course, our society prides itself on our intense education, our intelligence, being well-read, you know, all the magazines on the market, newspapers. We're well-read, we're studied, we're college-bred and all that. And yet, when it comes to the scriptures, we need spiritual Gerber and to be spoon-fed and all the rest. It's my opinion that people can't understand the King James because they don't read it at all. They're not used to it. It doesn't take long to get used to it. Now, I'm not saying that it's the only translation you should ever read. I'm just saying that the objection against it from that viewpoint really isn't that strong of a one, because anybody that spends any time Bible reading will catch on to the language of the King James. This thou sayest, that it won't bother you anymore after a while. But people that read the Bible, the 23rd Psalm on occasion, and maybe a verse or two before bed, they never are going to get used to it. They're never going to get used to the Bible in any format. And so the excuse that we constantly need a modern speech type translation or a real simple one so we can understand it, we're not treating the Bible like we'd treat a common old secular subject, which we'd go to the university, pay money, study, take tests, and listen to other men preach on or teach on. We'll do that with 20 or 30 different subjects on the way to a college degree, and we won't give the Bible a 1/100th the effort or time. And it's a shame, and it's not looking at it in a for a Christian, see, to be saying that, they're really sadly neglecting the Bible study at all. The King James has no real deficiencies that are of any great moment of any kind. I mean, they're simple things that can be gotten by, and even grade schoolers can read the King James without any problem. I'm not saying that I'm advocating it for them. I'm saying they can read it without any problem if they're used to it. There is another type of translation I won't cover in too much, but there are translations with a particular bias or doctrinal slant to them. The Mormons have put out a translation. The Jehovah's Witnesses have put out a translation. The Catholics have several translations, although they don't really have a doctrinal bias, but they do have some slight. There is an occult translation I have seen. There is a Christian Science translation. All of these have a very heavy doctrinal bias to support their ideas and thinking. The Catholic one, of course, the very least, it has only a very slight bias to it. But the others have a greater or lesser degree. Some of them, you would hardly even recognize it as the Bible at all by the time they've got done with it. Those type of versions aren't that popular in our circle, and so just to let you know, they do exist. There's another category of translation that's either a part of all of the above or not, and that are revisions of the King James. Just revisions of the King James. They have not seeked to expand, simplify, make it understandable or anything. They are just revising the King James. Of course, they're revising that part of the King James that is deficient in their view, and usually it's the thou sayest and the thee, and just putting you in and leaving off the ETH on verbs and so forth. And of course, it is more readable, so we could call them idiomatic, but they're not really purely idiomatic. They're basically revisions of the King James, is all they are. Revisions of the King James. Anyway, let me read an example of different types of translations just from a passage. Let me read you a simplified translation in Hebrews 12:1. You can look at it in your King James. Here's a simplified translation. All these many people who have had faith in God are now gathered round watching us. Let us put everything out of our lives that keeps us from doing what we should. Let us keep running the race that God has planned for us. Now, that's very simple. You couldn't fail to understand it. It may not have the precise wording there that was intended, though, that may tie into other passages. There may be linkage of key words that tie in and connect different thoughts that Paul had and the Holy Spirit had. But as far as understanding it, it's certainly simple, and you get the thought. A paraphrase of that translation, since we have such a huge crowd of men of faith watching us from the grandstands, let us strip off anything that slows us down or holds us back, especially those sins that wrap themselves so tightly around our feet and trip us up. Let us run with patience the particular race that God has set before us. Well, they've added the grandstand idea and some other things. Whether it's of any significance or not is to be decided. There are some passages where it's of considerable significance on a doctrinal issue. An amplified translation of the same. Therefore, then, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses who have borne testimony of the truth, let us strip off and throw aside every encumbrance, unnecessary weight, and that sin which so readily, deftly, cleverly clings and entangles us, and let us run with patient endurance and steady, active persistence the appointed course of the race that is set before us. So they've really amplified it and expanded it. And whether all those words are intended or not is to be decided. It does amplify it, though. It's a commentary on it. Then lastly, a literal translation on the same passage, which is, of course, the shortest of these. Surely in consequence, then, we also, having so vast a cloud of witnesses encompassing us, putting off every impediment and the popular sin, may be racing with endurance the contest lying before us. It may not sound too different than the others, but it is strictly down to just the very words that were there. The words they have chosen may not be the most understandable, like using the word impediment, but at least they have felt like that was what the Greek was intending, you know, some type of, you know, something that was bothering us, and so that's their choice. You always, the nice thing about the English languages is you have a choice of several in any one of these categories. For literal translations, I just read Concordant, but you can always check Rotherham, Young's, and several other literal translations, one against the other. There's always an advantage in more voices. As far as idiomatic translations, NIV, which is both a revision of the King James, but also the most idiomatic translation, I think, on the market today, New International Version. They declare emphatically that it is inspired, God has inspired it, and it is the only translation to be read by English-speaking people. In fact, they say that all foreign translations should come from the King James. Others throw the King James in the ash can, and they're totally against the King James, work hard against it, feel that it's completely deficient, has no purpose today, outdated, and for a number of other reasons. The real truth of the matter is somewhere in the middle between these two extremes. The reason for the King James was tonight the two main denominations in England in the early 1600s, the Anglicans and the Puritans. They each read their respective Bible, English translation, and it was decided that they should get together men from both viewpoints and produce a translation that would be read by the whole English realm. So anyway, 47 scholars were chosen. They divided themselves in different groups at the three main universities, Oxford, Cambridge, and Westminster. And they worked for 7 years on the translation of the King James. The King James translators, were they expanded, simplified, literal, idiomatic? They're pretty much a combination of all. More idiomatic and maybe literal than any of the others. There is some, I'd say some, in a very slight way, paraphrased, there are some expanded portions, but very slight. There are a number of literal passages, just a lot of them, and there are a number of idiomatic translations, although the idiomatic or the modern speech part is often phased, you know, from that century to ours, so it's not quite so idiomatic anymore. They spent 7 years on it. Their main emphasis, which is not in any of these categories, was looking for beauty, poetry, fitness of word, rhythm, tempo, and melody. They really produced a piece of literature, as any author might in writing a book. He will often use synonyms rather than just repeat the same word. It was big, big, big. I mean, he'll come up with big, huge, large. I mean, he'll make variety. Not to bore the reader. That's exactly what the King James did. They used considerable freedom in translating. And for example, the Hebrew word to give is translated 84 different English ways. The Hebrew word faith is translated 94 different ways, and I can give you many other examples. Looking at the other direction, 49 different Hebrew words are translated to destroy. 40 different Hebrew words are translated to set. And they have striven for variety, and that which sounds poetic, sounds beautiful, sounds like literature. And this hasn't really, I think, been that much of a hindrance to the King James. Because the men were in an age where they were reverent, and so they did not get onto slang, and I define slang, not swear words, but phrases that are tied to one period of time. There's lots of dig it, you know, that type of thing. That phrase doesn't mean what it meant, you know, today doesn't mean 50 years ago it meant something different. That would be slang. It's an expression that goes out of date and loses its meaning. Anyway, they did not have any of that, and they were reverent and conservative, and so I don't consider this to be, even though they use considerable freedom, I don't consider it paraphrasing or carelessness. They were, of course, some objections to this, and they replied, "Is the kingdom of God become words or syllables? Why should we be in bondage when we may be free?" Well, I don't believe the kingdom of God is words or syllables, but certainly the word of God is. And when you're translating the word of God, you are translating words and syllables, and that's about as, what can I say? So to exercise freedom in a translation, I mean, there is some question as to whether that's valid or not. But despite all of that, it is a drawback in the accuracy of the King James. Maybe it's the positive note in the beauty of it. The King James is not immediately popular. I won't go into all the details concerning it. It was not immediately popular. It was charged with bad theology, bad scholarship, and bad English. And although today it's considered to be beautiful English, yet at the time it was charged with bad English. Today it has many archaic words like ouches and tatches and kneesings and leasings and mufflers, which do not mean what we think it means, and a lot of other words that you would definitely get out of the dictionary, and in fact, to your dismay, would find it's not even in the dictionary. You would have to look up an older dictionary or even a specialized book that we have in the library that deals with just the archaic words in the King James. As far as the positive points for the King James, it's reverent. It has many excellent translations. And in my estimation, the biggest positive point at all is that it's universally accepted as the Word of God. It is the standard for just about everything. If you read Rotherham translation, and you go out and minister, you get the question, "Who's Rotherham? What's that?" What you preach, and if you read from it publicly, it doesn't come across. And if you read even the Revised Standard Version, which has had tremendous support and tremendous acceptance, even that isn't accepted by a large group of people, and a large group of them are quite adamant against it. And even NAS, as good as the New American Standard is, and as popular as it is, certainly doesn't come across in a lot of circles. And Good News, which comes across in many circles, is not accepted in others. And there's hardly any translation you can come up with that won't offend a certain segment of people. The Bible College at this church has made the King James their standard Bible, not because we think it's the best, but because it's universally accepted. Everybody will accept it, even if they read either Good News or RSV or NAS. If you get up and read out of the King James, it will not offend them. They will not be alienated from you. They will not question it. They'll accept it. The King, whether they read it personally or not, they will always accept it. It's universally accepted, and it is still read by the majority of Christians today, despite all the other translations. It's still read by the majority. For that reason, then, the King James is still a valuable translation. It's universally accepted. It's the one we read and read from. It's read in most churches, despite all the others. And if there should ever come a day where the King James is not read by anyone, then there would be no reason to hold it any longer, in my opinion. It's certainly not the best translation. I prefer NAS 100 times to it. But I won't read New American Standard or study out of it or preach out of it or even get my notes into it, because I know when I preach to other people, I'll be reading the King James. So I might as well get all my notes into it, you know, learn and expound it and so forth. It's been said that half of all critical commentators commentating, the words on the page of critical commentators are taken up with explaining the King James and taking care of difficulties that really didn't need to be there if the translation had been better. So a lot of preaching is explaining the text that may not even need to be said if the translation was adequate in the first place. Despite all of that, the King James still remains as the translation that is universally accepted. Not to say it's the best, it's just accepted. And based on that, you can't fight public opinion as it is. You have to work within it, and if they accept the King James, then the King James is it. Of course, we're not speaking of Catholics. They have their own translation. But among Protestants, the King James universally accepted. Let me branch out and just discuss briefly some other popular translations. Pros and cons. New American Standard Bible, the NAS, very popular, sold many millions of copies. It's a revision of a very accurate translation called the American Standard Version. At the turn of the century, there was a revision of the King James that was done jointly by both England and the United States that was a landmark of Bible translating. It was supposed to be the replacement for the King James, to be accepted by all Christians, read by all Christians, and the King James would then become outdated and put on the shelf, and the English Revised Version and then the American Revised Version, there were two of them, but they're practically synonymous, equal with each other, practically the same, one for England, one for the United States, that would replace the King James. And they are excellent translations. However, they're hardly ever read today, and the ERV is almost out of print. When the ERV was finished, it had sold over 2 million copies before it was even finished. When it was finished, it was transcribed. The entire New Testament was put on Morse code over the Atlantic to the United States. That daily issue of the Chicago Tribune contained nothing but the New English Revised Version. Their entire Sunday edition was nothing but the English Revised Version, the entire New Testament in that edition. It was very popular. Of course, today, you make a translation in the newspaper, you don't even know what you're doing. But in those days, there was a little more religious interest. And so it was headlines, news reporting. I mean, it was big news. However, the King James is still the most popular translation. The ASV and the ERV are practically extinct. There are some people that still read it. It's around. Anyway, it was thought that the American Standard Version was too valuable of a translation to go into obscurity. And so in 1963, they put out the New American Standard, or the NAS. The New American Standard. It's an update of the American Standard. It's an excellent translation. It's conservative. It's done by a group of evangelicals, Bible believers, believing in the inspiration of scriptures. It's very accurate. It's not without a few problems, which any translation would have. But still, it's overall excellent. It's easy to read, in my opinion, and it's very accurate. It's not a literal translation, but it is very literal in many places. It's produced by the Lockman Foundation, who was founded by a man named Lockman, who was a fruit grower in California who got saved. And when he got saved, he decided to dedicate his orange business to the Lord in a real way. And God blessed him in a real way until he became a millionaire in a very short time. And then he was a 2 millionaire, and a 3 millionaire, and a 5 millionaire, and he knew he had dedicated his business to the Lord, and he had quite a bit of money, and he was continually gaining in money and growing and prospering, and he was really growing financially. And he knew he needed, so he thought, well, I know what I'll do. I'll formulate the Lockman Foundation, and I'll funnel all this money into Christian work. And one of the projects that he did, and the Lockman Foundation did, was to make the New American Standard. They paid for it, paid the translators. And, of course, it has made the money since, despite all that. But it's hard to get them off the ground and get them done. That's expensive. The Lockman Foundation also put out the Amplified Translation and paid for all of that. But, of course, it sold a number of copies, and I'm sure they've gotten their money back. Anyway, the New American Standard, I think, is probably the best substitute for the King James. In my own opinion, others have it their own. But I still think it's probably the best substitute for the King James. The Revised Standard Version, which was very popular maybe a decade or two ago, not so popular today. It's competing with the New American Standard, and so there's competition there. But it came out in 1946, the New Testament. It was done by also a group of Christians of a more liberal bent than those that did NAS. NAS is more evangelical. RSV is more ecumenical. My own evaluation of the RSV is that it's a rather accurate translation. I don't think it's as accurate as NAS, despite what anyone says. In any study that I've ever conducted of the two, it'll always lose, and I've never seen any exceptions to that. I'm open to any other studies that someone else might try to prove to me that it's better. I have yet to see that. I don't think it has very many negative points, though. What I have noticed in studying the RSV is that it takes more flack from the Christian community than just about any other translation. It's always being attacked. In fact, one of the most popular nicknames is the reviled substandard perversion. However, In examining it and examining the claims, I have found they're completely exaggerated and that most of them could apply to Rotherham or even the King James. Anyway, I don't really have any specific objection to the RSV. I have none, not one specific objection. It's been charged with doing away with the virgin birth of Christ. I don't see why they would charge it with that. It has virgin birth right in the text. I mean, how can you be charged with doing it away if you have it right in the text? I mean, a lot of ambiguities have been objected to, and I don't feel that there's much, really any basis for the objections. My only complaint with the RSV is that there are others that are better. So, I have no complaint against it, other than I would prefer NAS. So, preferring NAS, I pretty much leave it on the shelf. But I don't have any specific objection against it. They were accused of tampering with the text. However, that's very insignificant. Very insignificant. Didn't really influence the translation that much, in my opinion. All the other arguments against it I have found to be of little consequence, just minor things. And the major arguments against it are completely false. They did believe in the virgin birth of Christ, or at least it's in the translation. I know there were men on the committee who were of a very liberal viewpoint. There are also men on the committee, like A.T. Robertson, who were of a very conservative viewpoint. And it was a committee translation, which you know is the compromise translation. Anyway, so much for the RSV. Another translation is the New International Version, which is very popular today and is a very recent translation. It came out in 1973. It sold several million copies. It's had quite a bit of advertising. Their initial advertising campaign, they spent $50,000 just on some preliminary things, and they've advertised heavy since, a lot of other things. New International Version is produced by a group of what I might call ecumenical evangelical scholars. It's not ecumenical liberal scholars, it's ecumenical evangelical scholars. Men that are real Bible-believing, born again, but of a very ecumenical mind. And I don't mean, there's two ecumenicisms, see. There's the World Council of Churches, real liberal ecumenicism, and then there's a much more conservative ecumenicism that probably will end up in the World Council of Churches also. But there is an evangelical ecumenicism. This is what produced this translation. It is, its main purpose was to be an idiomatic translation, and it is, after they translated it, they spent hundreds and hundreds of hours having children read it and getting their responses, and having people from different classes of society, different parts of the country, testing it out on them. I mean, whether they could understand it, and what do you think this means, and what does that word mean to you? And they tested it and tested it as far as its readability, and they've come up with what they call, they phrased it, truly as broad as Christendom, as one expression, and also easy to be understood, although not simplified and not a paraphrase. And it isn't, if you examine it, it isn't. I have found, oddly enough, that it resembles the RSV quite a bit. For one reason or another, I don't know why, but it does seem to. I feel it's a good translation. It doesn't have any negative points to it that I can really point to, other than I feel that NAS is superior. However, for readability, it's definitely superior to NAS, because it's just easier to understand. New International Version contained a large committee of men in very evangelical churches. Baptist, Brethren, Church of Christ, Mennonite, Nazarene, Reformed, different denominations like that, and scholars from those churches. Also several scholars from Oral Roberts University, for whatever they're worth. But even to the Pentecostal denomination, they consulted language experts, spent a lot of time on language, and so forth. The result is a readable translation without any real bias or errors in it of any consequence. It's not as literal or as accurate as NAS. Moving to translations of a completely different nature, Phillips' translation is very popular, and it's a completely different type of translation than the previous ones I've studied here. 1958 it came out. Phillips was a man from England. He was a vicar in the Church of England, and he produced a modern speech translation. You learn a lot about the translation by studying the background theologically of the translator. He's a vicar in the Church of England. However, he did not believe the Bible to be inspired. He said that Paul made haste writing in a hurry, made errors writing in a hurry. And he says, I haven't thought of any consequence to study Paul's writing microscopically, writing in a hurry, etc., etc., etc. He's even corrected Paul in error places that Paul was wrong. He uses a number of slang expressions. Jesus said, cast into hell. He says, thrown into the rubbish heap. And a lot of other places, just it's really full of this type of thing. There are some real subtle things that not that many people see, but Jesus, the King James said, blessed are the meek. Blessed are the meek. He says, happy are those who claim nothing. But, and some translation evaluations actually praise this as a good translation. But those who claim nothing usually are not Christians, not anybody that knows God. They're the more willy-nilly. Their mind is never made up about anything. It doesn't sound like anything that should be translated as meek. Meek is not to be interpreted as a yellow-bellied, spineless individual. It's to those that are humble, of a very contrite, meek spirit, who have great strength, tremendous patience and perseverance, but they're able to suffer tremendous things without having any reaction to it. You see, that's a meek person. He has tremendous strength. He's not flighty or weak in any way. As far as blessed are the peacemakers, Philip says, blessed are those that are utterly sincere. But utterly sincere is certainly not the gospel message. Jesus is teaching that many are sincerely wrong. Anyway, the translation is very ambiguous in many places. It's not very reverent. It contains a lot of slang. It's inaccurate much of the time, and I don't feel that it has any value at all for reading in private. I find the only value is to just expand an idea in your mind, to see how you would say it in a more easy-to-be-understood method. And other than that, as far as reading it daily, it's not going to give you the straight scoop of what was really said. It's slanted pretty heavily toward a liberal viewpoint. Another modern speech translation, which is actually more strictly a paraphrase, is Good News for Modern Man. Good News for Modern Man is very popular. It's gone through over 50 million copies. And let me say that there are few, very few books that could ever touch the number 50 million. Of course, the King James can, but I would say that I don't know of any other Bible translation that could touch this. Even Living Bible, which has hit some 20 and 30 million, I don't think they can get close to this. The Good News has hit 50 million mainly because it's given away rather than sold. But it's very cheap, very cheap. Even the Good News for Modern Man has been mostly New Testament. They have recently finished the Old Testament, and you can get both the New and Old Testament hardback for $2. Now, how many books you can get for that? Even Living Bible, they want $9.95 or $11.95, and $2, you can afford to give those away. The paperback copies go for 35 cents some places, and of course free in a lot of other places. Good News for Modern Man is an attempt to meet the need of non-Christians and those of low education. Now, I know that many new Christians read Good News and they just think it's wonderful, but it's really meant to meet the need of non-Christians and those of low education. And, of course, they may fit that category, and they may need to read Good News for a little while until they can get into a better translation. Good News contains a lot of slang, is very inaccurate in many places, and a lot of paraphrase. It is attacked by many. I have several books, Good News, Devil's Advocate, another one, Bad News. And I do think there is some validity to the arguments that they present there in those articles. A quote from the preface of Good News is, our translation is a faithful and accurate rendering of the books of the Greek New Testament. Well, in their opinion it is. And you notice that every translation that comes out states, the most accurate translation to date, the most literal, accurate, easy to understand. I mean, this translation is so perfect, you just have to buy one. And usually people do. Of course, everyone wants the best translation. If they're a real Christian and dedicated, they would have to have the best translation, the most accurate. And that's one of the things that does sell these translations. Good News also makes that claim, but it can be pointed out without much difficulty that it's full of errors. There was one objection that the good news doesn't translate the word blood very often. They often substitute death, his death, or something else. And I looked into that one, and I found it does take out blood quite a bit. And I don't know whether that's because they're of a liberal viewpoint, trying to get rid of the blood of Christ, which they have it in other places. They have it in about 50% of the places, and they have it out about 50% of the places. The word blood is a very simple word to translate. It doesn't seem to be very difficult to me to translate it blood. I mean, if the purpose of the translation is to meet the need of non-Christians and those with low education, the word blood certainly isn't that difficult. I can't understand why they changed it. But a lot of these translations have some pretty significant consequences, and especially since without the shedding of blood, there's no remission of sins, and how that blood ties in with everything in the Old Testament, I'm not so sure that they aren't of a very liberal viewpoint concerning the blood of Christ. John 3:16, a very popular scripture, "Whosoever believeth on him shall not perish." They translate, "Everyone who believes on him may not die." And I don't know whether they're trying to just make it easy to understand or whether they're watering it down or what. I don't read anything into it. I don't read any motive into it. I question, though, some things that were done. They don't seem to be for the best. The translator for all that was a Southern Baptist. One other translation that's very popular is Living Bible. Living Bible is an admitted paraphrase, never claimed to be a translation, states in the beginning of the translation that it is a paraphrase. It's done by Kenneth Taylor, who has, because of the popularity of the Living Bible, started his own publishing company, and he rivals the three main publishing companies, Baker and some of the other large ones, Zondervan. His publishing company just started from scratch, really rivals them now in its number of books sold and its broad base. Anyway, he has sold well over 20 million copies of the whole Bible, not to mention all the New Testaments that Billy Graham gives away and just all the others. It's really been popular. The main problem with the Living Bible is that it's a paraphrase, and it, as Billy Graham says, it will give you a new understanding of the Scriptures, and that's often what it does, much to not really the best understanding. It's quite full of theology. However, the translator is an evangelical, born-again Christian who is Bible-believing. So in light of that, I would say it's better than Phillips, but as far, theologically, but it often is full of many paraphrases, and many times he's ad-libbing. In Genesis, he has the sons of men and the daughters of God, or the sons of God and the daughters of men. He has angelic beings came down and all that type of thing. And he's going to get all kinds of things in there where he's added to the text. Anyway, I don't recommend Living for daily Bible reading. It's not for that. It's not for daily Bible reading. It's for those who can't read at all, hardly, or have no understanding. It's to be used, maybe, on occasion, to be able to say it in a different way, maybe in a more simple way. There is a translation in the Old Testament where the king says to another king, "Let not him that putteth on his armor boast as him who putteth it off." And Living translates it, "Don't count your chickens before they're hatched." And they do have the sense of the passage. They don't brag going into the battle like the one coming out. It has the sense of the passage. There are places where it does have the sense of the passage. Anyway, my time is up. Let me give you some more information another day.
Before we dismiss, I would just like to increase, I think, the strength of one of the points that Lanny has made. And he said that he didn't recommend like Goodspeed and the Living Bible and Phillips and some of these. I would like to make that even stronger. I think that it is absolutely dangerous to use those kind of translations as something that you will read regularly. Because you know what happens after a while? You read these things and they get into your mind and they're logged away, and your mind doesn't keep track that I got that out of the Living Bible or I got that out of King James. It all kind of gets rolled up into one in your mind, and after a while, you don't know where you got things, and you get these wrong ideas, and these are the things that are coming to your mind when you think about certain subjects, and you remember, oh, well, this word, and it's amazing how it colors and how it flavors and alters your interpretations of what the Bible really says, because that becomes the thing that your mind is fixed upon. And that's one of the reasons that I don't recommend at all listening to a lot of these radio preachers, and there's about 150 jillion different doctrines out here, many things of which, we would not agree on. And as soon as I know that some preacher on the radio out here or television or whatever it is preaching things that are very substantially different, and there's some good ones too, but if they're preaching something substantially different than I believe, I refuse to listen to them because I don't have my mind messed up about it. And so I think that it's dangerous, and I not only would not recommend those things, I would strongly recommend that you do not. Not that it's a sin or something to have it on your Bible bookshelf or your reference, because I'm sure as a reference book and just to see how they treat it and so forth is one thing, but to use it as something that you would read regularly. I would never give the Living Bible as a gift to somebody that I cared anything about. Or Phillips or Goodspeed. And unfortunately, in years past, I've had people give me copies of those kind of things because they thought, oh my, this is a wonderful thing, you know. But I refuse to read them. I'll just, occasionally look and see how their wording maybe compares against something else, more for amusement than anything. But I just wanted you to take that bit of perspective with you. It's even more than just don't recommend. I think that there is a considerable hazard and danger to the Christian to routinely and regularly read that as something where they would attempt to be getting the Word of God.